on the way, so maybe I'll get started. So today I want to talk about what Wojtylewski called free harmonic analysis. And the idea was to take the initial formulas that he found, later generalized them to show how non-crossing partitions come in, but initially Wojtylewski did it on more of a formal power series level, and then later he showed that you can use analytic functions to describe it. So the general idea is that you start with any probability measure on the real line, and you form this integral, which is called the Cauchy transform, and hope that you can take its inverse under composition. And as you find another function k, such when you compose it with g, you get z. You show that k will have a simple pole at the origin. So you subtract that pole, and what's left, you hope, is an analytic function. And so that when you have a compactly supported measure mu, then everything works quite well. If the measure is not compactly supported, then you have to work a little bit harder to show that you can take an inverse. And you do get an analytic function still, even for a measure with no moments at all. But that requires a fair bit of work to do. And I won't go through that part today. What I wanted to do is discuss the Cauchy transform and show some of its properties, and then use that to show that under reasonable circumstances, like a compactly supported measure, you can take K, and then work out an example with the semicircle law, just to go through all the things that we did for the semicircle law to see how they actually play out in a particular example. So the first thing is show that the Cauchy transform makes sense. So the first thing is, okay, so we're going to, let's get started here. So I'll generally write the real and imaginary parts of Z as X plus IY, and we're going to assume that Y is positive, and we'll let C plus be the complex numbers with positive imaginary part, and C minus if you take z in the upper half plane and you look at 1 over z minus t, and you say how small can the denominator be, the smallest it can be is when z is directly above t. And then this number is just this gives you 1 over the imaginary part of z. Okay, so that simple inequality implies that the integral converges, right? Because you're integrating a bounded function against a measure with a finite measure. Yep. Say it again. Y is greater than 0, yeah. Imagine that. You see me in the upper half plane. Okay, so, the picture you might draw is how small can the absolute value of z minus t be? Well, the smallest it can be is when is when Z's directly over T, and then that distance is just the imaginary part, it's just of Z. Okay, so this implies that the integral converges. Okay, now the next thing we want to do is show that G is analytic. Now there's a general theory that says when you integrate, when the integrand is an analytic function under, and you integrate it against a positive measure, say, you're going to get an analytic function. But here we can just do it directly. So let's just do that. Okay, so let's take a W. Oops. Let's draw the circle first. Take a W in the upper half plane. I want the radius of that to be half the imaginary part of W. Okay, just to make certain we don't get too close to the real line. And if you take a Z in there, then, and T, so we're saying that Z minus W is less than the imaginary part of W over 2, and T is any real number, then the absolute value of Z minus W over T minus W is going to be less than the imaginary part of W over 2. And the absolute value of T minus W is always less than 1 over the imaginary part of W. Okay, so we get that little inequality. So that means we can sum powers of this. This converges uniformly on this ball okay, and what does it converge uniformly to? Converges uniformly to T minus W over T minus Z. When you do the algebra. Okay. So, that gives us a little equation. 1 over Z minus T is equal to minus summation n going from 0 to infinity t minus w to the minus n plus 1 times z minus w to the n. Okay. And that means when we integrate, we can move the summation outside of the integral sign because we've got uniform convergence. And so let's see, where's the T? Okay, so it's T minus W to minus N plus 1 d mu of T times Z minus W to the N. Okay, so this gives us a power series expansion for G. Thus, G is analytic. On the upper half plane, because around each point I showed you can get a power series expansion. Another thing we want to see is the imaginary part. So let's start a new sentence. For if the imaginary part of Z is positive, then the imaginary part of 1 over Z minus T is negative. Okay, because putting it in the denominator means you changes the sign of the imaginary part. Therefore, G of Z is, you can't, if you integrate a bunch of points lying in the lower half plane, you could never get something on the boundary. Okay, you can actually prove that another way. Maybe we'll say that later on. Is that another reason you can't get on the boundary is because G is analytic. If you look at the imaginary part of G, that's a harmonic function. And if that were zero at some point in the upper half plane, then there's a mean value property for harmonic functions, which would mean that G was constant. Okay, and we'll see in a second that the Cauchy transform is never a constant function. Now here are two inequalities that are quite important. Actually, they're not inequalities, they're limits. But anyway, so. Lemma: the limit as y goes to infinity of y times g of I y is equal to minus I, and two, if you take the soup, so here I want to take the soup over all y strictly greater than zero and all x and r. And I take y times the absolute value of g of x plus I y. That soup is 1. Okay, so if you just prove that this is less than or equal to 1, and then you have this fact, then that shows the soup is actually equal to 1. Okay, so let's see. How we prove those two things. Okay, so they're both, you get both of them by the Lebesgue-dominated convergence theorem. So let's see, let's do the calculation. So let's see. We first calculate this. Let's take y times the imaginary part, and we'll show that that goes to minus 1. And we'll show that y times the real part goes to zero, and that will do the job. Okay, so we take y times the imaginary part of g of I y. Okay, so this is going to be the integral of y times the imaginary part of 1 over z minus t d mu of t. So, as I said, I'll just be assuming all along that z is going to be x plus i y. So this will be y And the imaginary part of this is going to be minus y over x minus t squared plus, whoops, sorry, there's no x. X is 0. So it's just t squared plus y squared. Okay, and there's no I there. Okay, so this is just minus the integral of y squared over t squared plus y squared d nu of t, which is minus the integral over 1 plus 1 t divided by y squared d nu of t. And notice that the absolute value of the integrand is bounded by 1, and 1 is an integrable function with respect to a finite measure. So that means we can use the dominated convergence theorem just to let y go to infinity inside. So this just goes to minus 1 by the dominated convergence theorem. Okay, and then the same kind of calculation. Okay, maybe I won't do it, but the same calculation, a slightly different function, gives you that the real part when goes to 0 when multiplied by y. Okay, so that proves the first part. And now, how do we get that bound? Okay, I think that's pretty easy. Y times g of x plus iy in absolute values is less than or equal to y times the integral of one of the absolute value of z minus t d nu of t, which is less than or equal to it's just going to be x minus t squared plus y squared, and square rooted, and the integrand is always less than 1, so you get less than or equal to 1. Okay, so that's that lemma. Now, here's the here's the theorem that shows you how to get the measure back if you know the Cauchy transform. Okay, so this is usually called Stokes' inversion. It says if you have two real numbers A and B, and A is less than B, and you take the limit, now instead of taking y goes to infinity, we're going to let y go to 0, but only through positive numbers. And we take minus 1 over pi times the integral from a to b of the imaginary part of g of x plus iy. And we integrate against x. Okay, so if you do that, then it says this limit is equal to the measure applied to the open interval AB plus one half of the measure applied to the two endpoints. So this is taking into account the possibility that you have atoms, that your measure might have atoms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, I should have said that. Thank you. Sorry, I said the right thing, but I wrote the wrong thing. Yeah. Okay, so and it says, so the next part is that if nu 1 and nu 2 are probability measures, on R, and they have the same Cauchy transform, then the measures are the same. Okay, that follows just because you can calculate the measure from the transform. Okay. So this calculation is actually a standard calculation in harmonic analysis, but it's usually done on the disk. So in fact, that's going to be a recurring theme here, that there'll be calculations done on the disk that are pretty standard, and you can turn them into the upper half plane using a fraction linear transformation. The formulas turn out to be usually a little more complicated, and you have to worry about a few more things because you've got a measure on an infinite set. You may not have not that big a compactly supported measure, but this is this one works fine. So we just start with a calculation. Let's take the imaginary part of G of X plus IY. So it's going to be the integral of the imaginary part of 1 over x minus t plus iy. Which is the integral of minus y over x minus t squared plus y squared. So this is the integral over R. Okay, so now I integrate this from A to B. Okay, so here I've got a compact or a finite interval, and here I've got a finite measure, so I can use Fabini's theorem to switch the order of integration around. And so I'm going to have the minus y over x minus t squared plus y squared dx d mu of t. Okay, but now this is a standard integral. I can actually work out exactly what it is. And so let's see, you get minus the integral over R, the integral from B minus T over Y to A minus T over Y, 1 over 1 plus X squared dx. So you make a little change of variables, and the change of variables is x primed is equal to x minus t over y. Okay, and that will transform this integral into this one, which is just an arctangent. I think it's okay, actually, because, let's see, dx is going to be y dx primed. So that's going to put a y squared up here, and then I add it in here, and this gives me x prime squared over there. Yeah, it works out perfectly. And so you get minus integral over R of tan to the minus 1 of b minus t over y minus tan to the minus 1 b minus t a minus t over y. And it, and now it turns out the integrand here converges to what in probability is called an indicator function. Well, it's an indicator function times a number. Okay, so that's, so that let f of say t and y be this integrand. Okay, and f of t be the limit as y goes to 0 through positive numbers of f of ty. Well, we do a little calculation. So it's going to split into two parts. So let's suppose that t is outside the closed interval AB. So it's either bigger than B or smaller than A. If it's bigger than B, then this is negative, this argument's negative, and this argument's negative. So as y goes to 0, this thing goes to minus infinity, and that goes to minus infinity. Each of these converge to pi by minus pi by 2. We take the difference. I get 0. The same as when you're below A. These two numbers converge, tan of minus, this goes to, if you're below A, this is positive, and this is positive, so both of these converge to pi by 2, and you take the difference. If, what happens if you're in the open interval AB? Anybody want to think about that? What happens when in the open interval? So that means this argument's positive and that argument's negative. So what happens? This one goes to pi by 2, this one goes to minus pi by 2. The difference is pi. Okay, and what's your, when you're at an endpoint, anybody say what happens at an endpoint? Okay, and at B, that's right, you get pi by 2. Now, I sort of gave the game away by saying the answer is the same, no matter which one. But what happens at A? When t is equal to A, this is, okay, when t is A, this is 0, and this just goes, and B minus A is positive, so this goes to pi by 2. Now, what happens when you're at B? Well, this is 0, so that's nothing, and now this argument's negative, and so this goes to minus pi by 2, but they have a minus sign in front of it, so you still get pi by 2. Okay, so the other thing we notice is that because the arctangent is bounded, the absolute value is always less than or equal to pi. So we can use dominated convergence again. We've got a probability measure, and we're integrating against something which is bounded. So that means we can push our limit through. And that's going to give us our formula. So, therefore, the limit as y goes to 0 through positive numbers of the integral from A to B of the imaginary part of g of x plus I y g x is minus the integral over the whole real line of f of t d mu of t. Yeah. Okay. So we write this integral as an integral over three parts. So we write the real line as, say, E1 union E2 union E3, where E1 is the complement of the closed interval, E2 is the two-point set, and E3 is the open interval. And so this integral is just a sum over these three pieces. It's zero on this. And on this one, it's just mu of the open interval AB and whoops, and times pi. And there's a minus sign missing. Or just minus. And then there's a one-half, a pi by two times the mass of the union of the two sets of the 2 points A and B. Now, of course, they could have mass zero. Okay, so when you divide by minus, minus pi, you get that formula up there. Okay, so that's Stokes' inversion. Okay, now a theorem which I'll just state. Okay. This looks like a complicated theorem. However, it's actually a fairly familiar theorem if you've studied Hardy spaces, HP spaces, any kind of harmonic analysis on the disk. But when you turn it into something on the upper half plane, it looks different. So this is a theorem due to Nevin-Lena, the R Nevin-Lena. So it says, suppose you take a function which maps the upper half plane into the lower half plane, and this condition, number two, holds. And the soup, where y is greater than zero and x is any real number, of y times the absolute value of g of x plus iy, suppose that soup is one. Then there is a unique probability measure mu on R such that G is the Cauchy transform of that probability measure. Okay, so this describes which analytic functions can occur as the Cauchy transform of a probability measure. Okay, so I won't go through the whole proof, but I want to give one formula at least that appears in the proof, and because I want to use that for something else. And here's the first step. This is the big step. There's another theorem also, and maybe this is really Nevin-Lena's theorem, I don't know. Actually, I haven't read Nevin-Lena's paper, so I'm just getting this from other books. And This is not such a standard theorem, so you have to dig a little bit in the literature to find it, and it's presented in maybe slightly different ways. So I forgot to put this in, analytic. Okay, so another theorem, and this is I'll say a little bit about this, says that if you have an analytic function G going from C plus to C minus, which is analytic, then there exists two numbers, alpha and beta, real numbers with beta negative, and a finite measure sigma on R such that G has an integral formula, but it's not a Cauchy transform. I think I'll get rid of this. So that G of Z is equal to alpha plus beta Z plus the integral over R of 1 plus TZ times Z minus T, divided by Z minus T, and sigma of T. So there's a more general theorem where you don't make this assumption here, but you get this kind of a transform. Then, so I put the details in the notes, but maybe I won't go through that. The condition that the soup over y greater than 0 and x running over the real numbers of y times the absolute value of g of x plus I y equals 1 implies that beta is equal to 0. Okay, I mean, what you have to do is take this expression and look at the real and imaginary parts, multiply by y, and that's just going to force some conditions, and one of them is that beta is 0, and the other condition is that alpha is equal to minus t, is equal to minus the mean. Okay. Then when you plug that back in to this formula, you get that, oh yes, and one other thing, okay, and it forces another condition that the integral of 1 plus t squared d sigma of t is finite. Okay, so a little bit of fiddling with this, you get those three conclusions. Essentially, by looking at the, you look showing taking this and writing real and imaginary parts and doing it separately. And so you let, you define a new measure to be the integral over E of 1 plus T squared d sigma of T. Actually, it turns out that this is actually equal to that soup. It's actually 1. So you define a new measure like this, and then when you run all that through the calculations, you get that G is the Cauchy transform of nu. Okay. So that's just the idea, the proof. The hard part is to show the existence of this thing. Now, I mean, what you do is you map the upper half plane into the unit disk. So you make a function. So you start with the upper. You start with the disk. You map to the upper half plane, and then you compose with G. So that means you go from the disk, the unit disk, into the lower half plane. So then you multiply that function by I to rotate it 90 degrees. So now you have a function from the disk into the right half plane, and the real part of that will then be a positive harmonic function on the disk. Okay, well, there's a theorem that says every positive harmonic function in the disk is given by integrating a measure, a positive measure, on the circle. Okay, and then you unwind all that stuff back, and you get this formula here. So that's how it goes. Okay, so... So this tells you how to identify a function as being the Cauchy transform of a measure. Okay, now one other theorem, and I think I'll state it and do some initial remarks, and then we'll take a break, is about convergence of measures and convergence of Cauchy transforms. Okay, so suppose that we have a sequence of probability measures on R with Gn, the corresponding Cauchy transforms. Okay, so we suppose that Gn, the sequence, converges pointwise. To G on the upper half plane, and this G satisfies that condition up there. The sheep over positive y's and x arbitrary of y times g of x plus I y absolute value is equal to 1. Okay. Then we know, we don't know, but anyway, I'll say this. Then there exists nu, a probability measure, on R, such that nu n converges in distribution to nu, which means for all continuous bounded functions on the real line, the integral of f against d nu converges to the integral of f against nu. I don't know who prove this theorem, actually. You just find it in the, maybe it's a folklore theorem, I'm not certain. Okay. Now, this theorem, yep. Yes. And G of Z now my limited understanding of how random matrices get used in real applications, this theorem is quite important, because what you do is you want to see how the distribution converges, so you go to the Cauchy transforms and you just examine how the Cauchy transform behaves, and from that you want to infer that the actual probability measures converge. So instead of, you forget about the measures and you just work with the Cauchy transforms, and this theorem shows you what you get. Okay. Let's see, let me see where a good, I don't think I can do the whole thing in 5 minutes, so let me make some, let me make a few remarks to get started. Actually, according to that clock, it's only 3 minutes. So what we need to use is a theorem in complex analysis called Montel's theorem, or at least it was in my complex analysis book. And it says this: you're looking at functions defined on some open subset, connected open subset of the plane. You've got a family of functions. In our case, it's going to be a sequence of functions, but it doesn't have to be countable. And suppose you know that whenever you take a compact subset of your domain, that your whole family is uniformly bounded on that compact subset. Then it says that your family is relatively compact in a certain topology. And the topology you always use is uniform convergence in compact sets. So let me see if I can write that down. I'm calling it Montel's theorem, but actually I don't have my book handy. And there's some possibility it's called Vitali's theorem. Since I haven't actually read either of those papers, and that's still hearsay, but I'm going to stick with Montel for the moment. So suppose, let's say, B contained in the complex plane is open, and I don't think this matters, but let's just throw it in and connect it. And that script F is a collection of analytic functions on D, such that for all K contained in D compact, the soup of the absolute value of F of Z as Z runs over K and F runs over script F is finite. So there's one bound that works for all the functions on that compact set. Then we have that the closure of F is compact in the topology of uniform convergence compact subsets. Of D. So in particular, if F is a sequence, then it says that then every subsequence of GN has a convergent sub-subsequence. Okay, because saying the closure is compact for a sequence means that every sequence has a convergent subsequence. So we can apply this to every subsequence, and we always get a convergent subsequence, sub-subsequence. Okay, so I think I'll stop there for 10 minutes, and I'll come back and show you how to use that to prove that convergence theorem on the right. Okay, so let me start on the proof of this theorem now. So, the first thing we can see is that from one of our inequalities, but perhaps it's gone now, that the absolute value of g of z is less than or equal to 1 over the imaginary part of z. Okay. And that's because let's just check that. So that's less than or equal to the integral of z minus t. And the question is, how small can that be? Smallest it can be is the imaginary part of z, and then we integrate against probability measure. So that doesn't depend on the measure. That bound doesn't depend on the measure. So that means in your plane, the sequence of Cauchy transforms are uniformly bounded on every set of this type. And that means we can use Montel's theorem then. That means they're uniformly bounded on every compact subset of the plane. Therefore, there exists G tilde analytic on C plus and a subsequence GNK such that GNK converges to G tilde uniformly on compact subsets of the upper half plane. And thus, G tilde is analytic but GNK converges to G pointwise, that's our assumption, therefore G must be G tilde is analytic. Okay, so that's an argument that gets used quite a bit in this business. Now, what do we know? We know that G maps C plus into the closure of C minus. Because we're taking a limit, we might get into the closure. But then we would have the same problem as before. If the imaginary part of z is positive, in other words, we take a point in the upper half plane, and the imaginary part of g of z turned out to be zero, then the imaginary part of g would be a harmonic function on the upper half plane that assumed a minimum value at a point in its interior, which is impossible unless G is constant. Then G would be constant. Okay, but G cannot be constant because okay, I'll go over here. Note that the soup over positive y's and real x's of y times the absolute value of t plus x plus iy is less than or equal to 1. Because it's true for every n, and g is a pointwise limit. Thus, g is not constant. Okay, because if this were constant, and this can be big, then it couldn't... let's see. I guess it could be zero and still satisfy that condition. But the soup, I mean, when you soup over... Good. That assumption prevents it from being zero, but let's see. If the soup is zero, then g is constant. I'll come back and say something about that. So it can't be constant. Anyway, good. Thank you. The pointwise convergence gives us this inequality, but we actually assume something stronger, equality. Okay, I forgot to read my own statement there. So g is not constant, therefore g of c plus is actually contained in c minus. And g is analytic. Okay. Okay, so we can use, and I think I just erased it. Okay, so by Nevin-Meenan's theorem, there is a probability measure. Nu on R such that G is the Cauchy transform of nu. Okay. Now I have to invoke a theorem in probability theory. It's not that hard to prove. It uses the fact that the rationals are countable and dense in the reals and Cantor's diagonalization procedure. So it's not that hard, but it's called Helly's selection theorem. There is a subsequence of our original sequence of measures. That converges to a measure let's call it nu tilde, I think. Nu tilde in the so I'll say weakly on C0 of R. So what does that mean? For all functions continuous on the real line and vanishing at infinity, the integral of f of t, the new nk of t, converges to the integral of f, the new tilde of t. Okay, so you get relative compactness of a sequence of probability measures, but only in a weaker topology. Okay, that's what you get from the Helly selection theorem. Okay, but yeah, so let's see if they can get. Okay, so the function z goes to 1 over z minus t is in C naught of R. Okay, so you take z not on the real line, in particular in the upper half plane, that this function goes to 0 as t goes to infinity. Okay, so therefore, gnk of z, which is the integral of this thing against d nu nk, converges to the Cauchy transform of nu tilde. Therefore, g must be the Cauchy transform of nu tilde. Okay, so, now one little, so let's see, I don't think I quite did this, but this soup is actually the total mass of the transform. So, nu tilde of R, that comes out of the, out of those inequalities. Remember, we always ended up by showing that something converged to one using the dominated convergence theorem. So nu tilde is actually a probability measure. Okay, so what we have is that thus this sequence. Okay, so this is another little fact that if you have convergence in this weaker topology to a probability measure, you get convergence in distribution. Okay, you can, if you know it's a probability measure, you can replace your continuous function vanishing at infinity by a bounded continuous bounded function. Okay, that's another little argument. So, what we've shown is that you always get a subsequence converging to a probability measure. But it always has to be the same thing because of this, it always has to be the probability measure of which G is the Cauchy transform. So every subsequence converges to the same thing. So the whole sequence must converge to the same thing, and let's call that same thing nu in distribution. Okay, and that means we have a probability measure. We have this convergence, and G is the Cauchy transform of that that limit. Okay. Let me just mention one other point. Suppose you don't assume this. Now, I mentioned this soup you get automatically by pointwise convergence of the G's that this soup is less than or equal to 1. You still get a theorem. The theorem is you don't get this part goes out, and that gets replaced by a weaker convergence. So if you just follow through the proof, you'll see that that's what happens. Now, just one other point before I go on. I mean, you can see why you might want to do this. Suppose you just take a point mass. Okay, let's make it a little more interesting. Take a point mass at 0 and a point mass at n and take the average to get a probability measure. This will just converge to a measure which only has a mass at 0. And the mass will be 1/2, so you don't get a probability measure. And it turns out you won't get this kind of convergence. You'll have to assume that your functions get small when you get away. Otherwise, this function could pick up that mass at n. So that shows what happens if you weaken that. Okay, so maybe I want to look now at compactly supported measures. And show you some simplifications that happen for compactly supported measures. And then connect that to the R transform. Okay, so let's suppose the support of our measure is contained in the interval minus r to plus r, where r is some positive number. Then we have moments. Okay, because now this is a t to the n is a bounded function. And a crude estimate gives it the moment is no bigger than r to the n. The nth moment is no bigger than r to the n. So we can form the moment generating function. And this converges if the absolute value of z is less than r to the minus 1, using that estimate there, just the one for a geometric series. Now, if the absolute value of z is greater than r, then we can get a Laurent series for the Cauchy transform. Okay, then the absolute value of z inverse is less than r inverse, turning that around, and so the Cauchy transform okay, so now this thing is less than 1 on our, so I can move the sum outside. And have that. Okay, and therefore I get the relation that this is 1 over z times m of 1 over z. Okay, so when you have a compactly supported measure, the Cauchy transform has a nice Laurent series. Now, what we want to do is we want to show that I can take an inverse of the Cauchy transform if I restrict Z. So let's see. Okay, so I let f of z be equal to z times m of z, which is g of 1 over z. So I want to show that if z is small enough, that f has an inverse. Show that if the absolute value of z is less than 1 over 2r, then f is 1 to 1. Okay, so let me just, that's bad writing, let me fix that. Show that f is 1 to 1 on set of z such the absolute value of z is less than, actually I remember now, it's 4r. Okay, and that the image of this set under f contains a ball, also contains a ball. A 1 over 6r. So that if you make z small enough, the function f is 1 to 1, and not only that, on this ball, it's the image of it contains another ball. So f inverse is defined on an open set, on this open set here. Because there's an open set containing the origin contained in the image of f. And f is 1 to 1 on this ball here. Okay, so let's see how to do that. And from that we'll be able to get our function k that we that I mentioned at the very beginning. Okay, so this is just a bunch of very simple estimates. Okay, so let's just note a couple of things. F of 0 is 0. F prime of 0 is 1. Okay, those are easy calculations. Suppose you take two numbers, z1 and z2. Now here's a bit of a trick. This is in a paper of Voiculescu and then modified a little bit by Hodorop. Anyway, I wouldn't have figured this out myself. How are you going to show that the function is 1 to 1? Well, here's what you do. You look at f of z1 minus f of z2 over z1 minus z2. Okay, let's put some absolute value signs on it, and we say that that is bigger than the real part of the same thing. And we write this thing as an integral. So the real part stays the same for the moment. And I write it as the integral from 0 to 1 of a derivative. And the function u, you take z1 plus t times z2 minus z1 divided by z2 minus z1. Right, because this is an integral of the derivative, so you just evaluate this at 0 and 1, and you get that. But when you differentiate this thing with respect to t, you're going to get f primed at this, and then this comes out and cancels that. Okay, so now we just want to get a lower bound on the real part of the derivative. And, okay, the point is that the derivative at zero is one. So if you don't stay, if you don't go too far away from zero, you can't go too far below one. So now actually we're going to do something a little break. We're actually going to find an actual lower bound. But maybe since time is running out, I mean, that would be enough, right? You know that if you have a continuous function, it's equal to 1 at 0. If you don't go too far away from 0, then it shouldn't go too far below 1, so the real part will still be positive. And therefore, when you integrate this, this will be some positive number, and that means if these two guys are different, then these two guys are different, so it has to be 1 to 1. Okay. So what is the actual estimate? Let me just write this down. So this is greater than or equal to 2 minus 1 over 1 minus the absolute value of z times r squared. Okay, what you do is you just get that by taking the expansion for this. Okay, this starts with a z, and the derivative starts with a 1. And you take all the other terms, and you do some little approximations, you turn it into a geometric series that you can sum, and you get this expression here. And so the smallest this thing can be is when z is up at r, and it turns out to be 2/9. Okay. And So there's actually a little bit more. Okay, so so what we get is that the absolute value of f of z1 minus f of z2 is greater than equal to 2/9 z1 minus z2 if absolute value of z1 and the absolute value of z2 are less than, strictly less than, I think. Actually, I forget. I don't think it matters anyway. Let's just say strictly less than. Okay. Here's another little conclusion, is that we do a very similar calculation, and maybe this will be in the notes. So just doing the same thing, you do the expansion. This first term is a z, and then you say, well, how big can the rest of it be? And it turns out the rest of it can't be any bigger than 1/3 of z, provided that z is small enough. And then you get that inequality. Okay, so what does that give us? that's going to tell us that if I look at those two sets I have on this board here, two disks of different radii, it says that F, let's just say gamma R is a circle of radius 1 over 4 R. If you're on the boundary, if Z is actually has this size, then this thing over here will be, which way is this going to go? This will, let me just get the argument right here. What have we got? Maybe I better use some notation. So let D1 be this disk of radius 1 over 4R, and D2 be the disk of radius 1 over 6R. Okay, so we have that F is 1-to-1 on D1. We also know that F takes, we let this curve gamma just be the boundary of D1. Okay. And so F of gamma only wraps around 0 once. Okay, you get that by 1-to-1-ness and what's called the argument principle. Okay, so you take the image of the boundary of this thing. And it's some curve that goes around the origin, but it can only go around it once. And the interior of this disk goes to the interior of that disk. But the image of this disk is always bigger than this smaller disk. So that means that D2 lies in the image of D1. And that's the thing we wanted to prove. That the image of this small disk contains this slightly smaller disk. Okay, now, that's more or less the end of it. Just some algebra now. F minus 1 be the inverse function. Okay. F minus 1 of 0 is 0. F minus 1 prime of 0 is 1 by the chain rule. Okay, because of these conditions and the chain rule, the inverse function satisfies these conditions. Okay, so thus the inverse function has a simple 0 at z equals 0. Therefore, if I define k of z to be the reciprocal of the inverse function, this is meromorphic on D2 with a simple pole. At z equals 0. Okay, so if I take R of z to be K of z minus this, the pole that it has, 1 over z, then this is analytic. On D2. And to conclude, we get that this R satisfies the same formulas that William showed us last week, which we got combinatorially. Okay. So, let's just check that. So what do we get? We get K of G of Z is 1 over F inverse of G of Z. Now, okay, it's gone now. Remember, F of Z was equal to z times m of z, and g of z was equal to 1 over z m of 1 over z. So that's f of 1 over z. So this is 1 over f inverse of f of 1 over z. So K is the inverse of the Cauchy transform, and easy calculation goes the other way. Okay, and that's exactly the thing that we couldn't prove. Well, the thing we didn't know before is that this function G had an inverse. And so what we have shown is that if you start with a compactly supported measure, the Cauchy transform on a small neighborhood of zero has an inverse, which is a meromorphic function with a simple pole. And you remove the pole, and you get an analytic function. And that's what's called the R transform. Okay. Now, I think it's good to do one example. I should have done more than one, but anyway, it looks like it's only going to be one. And try and follow through all of these things for the semicircle law. Okay, so this is the case where you have a measure which lives on minus 2 to 2 and with the density given by the semicircle. Okay, the moments are 0, n is odd, and if n is even, you get c sub n over 2, where cn, remember, is the nth Catalan number. So the moment generating function. Oh, okay, but there was one little thing. I think Roland showed this last time, that if you do the following thing, if you take all positive integers such that the sum is equal to k, you take cm times cn, you get ck plus 1. That's the recurrence formula for the Catalan numbers. And this implies that if you take m of z and you square it, You multiply by z squared, you get m of z minus 1. Okay, that's a little calculation involving generating functions. But you just take the generating function, you square it, you're going to get a product of things. You use this thing, everything's fine except the first term. So let me just see that I've got that right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so we know that the moment generating function satisfies a quadratic equation, we solve the quadratic equation. The quadratic equation has a plus minus in it. But we check to see what happens at zero. We want to have m of 0 is equal to 1. That's the way we set up the moment generating function. And this implies that we choose the minus sign. Okay, so then we plug in the formula for. And we do a little algebra, and you get this. Now, let's go back to this equation here. We have 1 plus z squared, m of z squared is equal to m of z. So if I replace z by 1 over z, that's going to be 1 plus 1 over z times m of 1 over z squared is equal to m of 1 over z. Okay, and that means that 1 plus g of z squared is equal to z times g of z. Okay, so that's a quadratic equation satisfied by the Cauchy transform, and that implies that z is equal to g of z plus g of z inverse. Okay, just dividing both sides by g of z. Now we know that g has an inverse close to the origin. So, and we look, this tells us exactly, if you know g, how do you find z? So that means that k of z is equal to z plus z inverse. Because k is going to be the inverse of g. So that implies that r of z is z. Okay, which was already shown. Now, one other little thing I wanted to finish off with, since there's just a few minutes left, is just... let's see what happens when we do Stokes' inversion on this Cauchy transform. You can actually see that the inversion theorem works. So this is it. Okay, so what we have to do is I'll have to calculate the imaginary part of g of x plus I y. Okay, so this is going to be the imaginary part. Well, let's see, I'm going to pull off a 1/2 out front. So it's going to be the imaginary part of x plus I y minus this square root. So I'm going to keep it as a z here. Okay, so it's going to be 1/2 times y minus the imaginary part of this thing. Now, I hadn't really said how I'm choosing the branch here of this square root. So here's how you choose the branch. So here's your point Z in the upper half plane. Call this angle theta 2. Call this angle theta 1. And then you write Z squared minus 4 has Z minus 2 square rooted times Z plus 2. And so that's going to be the square root, to take the modulus, write it in polar form. Because when you square root, you half the angle and square root the modulus. So this is equal to the absolute value of Z squared minus 4 to the 1/2 times e to the I theta 1 plus theta 2 over 2. Okay, so the imaginary part of this thing is just going to give me the sine. Okay, so calculation's just about finished. We just have to see what happens as y goes to zero. So let's see, what is the limit as y goes to zero from above of the imaginary part of the square root of z squared minus 4? Okay, I mean, this part, that's supposed to be a 2. This part goes to 0, so this is the only thing that's going to make a difference. So, okay, as y goes to 0, z squared minus 4 just goes to x squared minus 4. So I'm going to have the absolute value of x squared minus 4 to the 1/2 times the limit as y goes to 0 of the sine of theta 1 plus theta 2 over 2. Okay, so there's, let's take the case x is greater than 2, minus 2 is less than x is less than 2, and x is less than minus 2. So this is going to stay the same no matter what the x is. So if x is bigger than 2, that means you're over here and you drop down to the real line. Well, both theta 1 and theta 2 go to 0. Get a 0. If you're over here, both theta 1 and theta 2 go to minus pi. So the average is minus pi, and sine of minus pi is 0. So you get a 0. Now, what happens if you're in the middle? Well, theta 1 goes to pi, and theta 2 goes to 0, so you get pi by 2. Sine of pi by 2 is 1. Okay, so the answer is 4 minus x squared, square rooted, if the absolute value of x is less than 2, and 0, the absolute value of x is greater than 2. Okay, and that means when we take the limit as y goes to 0 from above of minus 1 over pi, times the imaginary part of g of x plus iy, put all that together, I have two minus signs, one here, one here. They cancel. There's a 2 over there, so I'm going to have a 1 over 2 pi And I'll have the square root of 4 minus x squared. If the absolute value of x is less than 2, and I'll have 0, the absolute value of x is greater than 2. Okay, so we'll recover the semicircle law. And I don't think we have decided what it's going to be, who will be talking next week. Probably me. That's it for today.